Welcome back to Dads on the Air, this 21st day of June 2011. 21st day of June, I think that's the shortest day of the year, but it won't affect us on this program. We'll be carrying on with, we've got some interesting guests today, but before we go any further, I should introduce myself. I'm Bill Cable from Mediate Now. With me in the studio, just the two of us today, is Ian Purdy.
Good morning, Bill. Good morning, listeners. Yes, a bit lonely in here this morning compared to how it has been the last few weeks. We've practically had a party on in here.
Yep, so it's if anyone who wants to check on Ian's output, you can go to ianpurdy.com.
Absolutely. I recommend everybody do it immediately. There's all sorts there.
Yep. Now, there's been a few interesting happenings in the news. I suppose the first thing to note is that last Sunday, the 19th of June, was Father's Day, not in Australia. We've got to wait till September in Australia, but certainly in the USA, Canada and UK, it was Father's Day on Sunday, so we wish to...
Was it in New Zealand?
I don't know.
Because I may have missed if it. Well, I didn't ring my dad and say, Happy Father's Day, Lloyd. If you're listening, Dad, and I missed it, Happy Father's Day. I think New Zealand and Australia would be the same, I would imagine.
I would
think
so.
We're Anzacs. I don't imagine we'd have a different Father's Day over the other side of the ditch than we have over here.
Yeah, I think it's a Northern Hemisphere change that 19th of June. But
They're all weirdos up there.
Anyway, from us down here to all you dads in the Northern Hemisphere, we wish you a very happy Father's Day for last Sunday. And we've got a few other stories here. I notice in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 20th of June, there's a story about an heroic father who in Victoria. This is a father who's being hailed as a hero after dragging his wife from their burning house and then returning to try to save his 10-year-old daughter. This is Tony Guerra, who was 43, and his wife Kylie, 38. They found their house in Sorrento on Victoria's Mornington Peninsula was ablaze, and the fire started about 7 a.m. on Saturday morning. As soon as they realised what was going on, they tried desperately to get their daughter Brittany out of the house. Apparently she was holding hands with one of her parents and then went back for whatever reason. Tony Guerra, the father, managed to get his wife out, but when he realised his daughter wasn't with him, he went back in, and unfortunately both Tony and his daughter Brittany died in the flames. So a tragic story.
That is. So he got her out and she went back in.
She was on her way out of the house, apparently, and then they just lost her. So she's gone back in.
Oh, okay. Well, she wanted to get something. She forgot some important thing that she thought she needed or something.
Yep,
went into the house to get it, and Dad followed her in, and that was the last anybody saw of them alive.
That's right. So, and yet another heroic story from a dad, I suppose, is the way we can look at it. But and I suppose the other lesson is, if it's a lesson, everyone should have smoke alarms. But anyway, heroic actions by the father in that case. I noticed also in the Sydney Morning Herald on the weekend edition, there was a question posed: is the health system failing men? And four very interesting responses. One was from John McDonald, who we know well. He's the professor and foundation chair in primary health care at the University of Western Sydney and a patron of the Australian Men's Shed Association. Then there was a specialist, Gary Jennings, who's a cardiologist and the director of Baker IDI Heart and Diabetes Institute. Then a GP who had some very practical suggestions, Dr. Greg Malka, who's been a GP in rural Victoria for something over 25 years. And finally, Dr. Andrew Penman, the chief executive of the Cancer Council of New South Wales. And the theme seems to be that if, for instance, you had a party and no one came, you wouldn't question the people that didn't come. You'd question what was wrong with the party. And that seems to be the problem in getting men to take advantage of health services that are available. Now, there are some steps being taken. In the GP's case, he has twice weekly evening clinics, and just to make it easier for men to get to their health services, and perhaps they should be made more male friendly, because that's something we hear often, is that the men aren't going to get medical advice, they then suffer, and that's reflected in the figures. Compared to women, men are 80% more likely to die from mostly preventable cancers that are common to both. So that sort of thing contributes to the longevity gap. But if the right steps are taken, and the example Dr. Penman gives is that in 10 years, men have lowered their risk of dying from lung cancer by 16%, and this is much higher than the reduction in the women. So,
but isn't that just because less people are smoking cigarettes? I mean,
well, it is, but men have heeded that message perhaps more so than the women, and as a result, they've lowered their risk of dying. So,
well, right, but it's got nothing to do with going and having tests done on their lungs or.
Well, you know, I guess it's all they're all factors. Obviously, smoking and lung cancer is very closely linked. But the point I think is that if you get the message across to men on health that they are prepared to do things about it, and one of the things they can do, or there are a number of things they can do, they could get more regular health tests, they could get more exercise, the usual things, get off that chair and or the couch and get out there and do some running or get yourself fit. Keep an eye on your blood pressure, eat proper foods, all those sorts of things are going to help if you for men in their health, their overall health, and it should all be part of the various government health plans that are starting to come out, health policies. So yeah, there's a bit
absolutely
to watch out for and a bit of hope there in the in at least in one area.
Well, I've got a couple of articles here. These, on the face of them, would appear to be contradictory. Last Wednesday's Telegraph, there was an article under the heading, Wife's Yawn Warns. The article states, men, if your wife is having trouble sleeping, be aware that it could ruin your marriage. But a man's inability to fall asleep at night does not have the same effect, a study shows. It found that wives who have difficulty sleeping reported more negative interactions with their partner the following day and fewer positive ones. Husbands had a similar reaction the day after their wives had a disturbed night. So if she doesn't sleep well, the next day can be hell. Well, that makes sense. However, it goes on but a husband's sleep had no effect on either partner's reports on the quality of their marriage. Curiously, however, husbands' reports of more positive interactions were often followed by getting less sleep the night before. Well, less sleep might equate to more sex. So he's woken up happy. The article goes on. Research from a previous study by the same researcher found that the presence of a husband or partner meant women slept better. So there you go. Now this would be appear to be contradicted by this horrifying article, which also appeared in the Telegraph. Sleep-deprived husband on murder charge. New York. A husband has been charged with murdering his wife because she kept on disturbing his sleep. Ronald Stolberg is alleged to have suffocated his 54-year-old wife, Rachel, after she woke him several times during the night. After the alleged killing, he went back to bed and even later went to work before reporting her death at their home in Vernon Hills, Illinois. So that would not tend to back up the first article that seems to imply that men seem to be able to absorb the effects of a lack of sleep more than women do. Women tend to take it out on their partner, it would appear, if I'm reading between the lines correctly, whereas men just don't tend to take it out on their wife if they're not getting enough sleep. Perhaps they go and take it out on road rage or something. Who knows? But anyway, those two articles would seem to contradict themselves. I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Now, here's an article from the Telegraph in London. This is dated the 18th of June 2011. You might have seen it picked up by the local papers, but David Cameron, the British Prime Minister.
Oh, you heard about that. What did he say? Yeah.
He's launched a full-scale attack on fathers who abandon their families, calling for them to be stigmatised by society in the same way as drink drivers are. The Prime Minister's intervention in an article for the Sunday Telegraph, and get this, to mark Father's Day.
Oh, good on you.
Is one of the most outspoken he has ever made in defence of traditional what he regards as traditional family life, which he describes as the cornerstone of our society. Mr. Cameron said, Britain needs to be made a genuinely hostile place for runaway fathers who deserve the full force of shame heaped upon them and are beyond the pale. So sees that as a way, but the reality, the truth is that many so-called fathers who abandon their families are actually evicted by deceit.
Yeah, or driven out by women who don't want them there and make life impossible for them in the family home.
Yep. That's right.
And then, of course, their children are taken away from them. The only role that's acknowledged for them of being meaningful is as a wallet, basically. And that's the only relationship they're allowed to have with their children, is that they pay for them, which is not satisfactory for any man anywhere.
So very disappointing that the Prime Minister of the UK would choose to come out.
Well, he's a conservative, isn't he? He's, you know, harking back to the 1800s or something, when life was a lot different to how it is now.
And yeah, and particularly that he'd choose Father's Day to launch his attack. But anyway, that seems to be par for the course these days. Now, then another article here is also on the bad news front, but and a bit closer to home. But in Western Australia, it is proposed to introduce some of the country's toughest laws against domestic violence, requiring a presumption of imprisonment for offenders who breach violence restraining orders, what they call, we call AVOs, they call VROs in Western Australia. And if an offender breaches a violence restraining order three times, there's going to be a presumption of imprisonment. So taking that right away, the ability to make a decision on the facts is going to be taken away from the judges, and it's going to be they're proposing to enshrine it in the legislation. Now, what really is very concerning about this, and is that the reasons given don't add up. Mr. Christian Porter is the Attorney General, and he said that stronger laws were needed to address the increasing scourge of domestic violence. Now, if he cared to look at his own figures for Western Australia, he would see that in the last year, 9,102 VROs were granted, which happens to be the lowest number since 2007. So, in fact, the Law Society of Western Australia has questioned the need for any amendment to the laws. They say where offenders commit actual violence when breaching a violence restraining order, the courts usually imprison them anyway. So what actually is the need for this amendment? The Law Society is against presumptive imprisonment where breaches do not involve violence, particularly in circumstances where there are consensual breaches, where they have reconciled but failed to lift the order. Now, that can happen. There might be an attempt for the parties to get back together again, and they don't worry about the order, the VRO, which might still be in place. But as a result of that, if the courts don't have the discretion to deal with that sort of breach, it's into jail. So we can only hope that that some common sense prevails in Western Australia, but unfortunately...
Well, unlikely in Western Australia.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And all of this taking discretion away from judges. I mean, that's what judges are for. They're there to look at the specific facts of a specific case and apply the law. I mean, all of these, you know, these mandatory jail sentences or whatever, I mean, this is ridiculous. This is taking the flexibility out of the law, turning it into an even blunter, more brutal instrument than it needs to be.
Yes, and the hope isn't great here, because the opposition leader, a fellow by the name of Eric Ripper, said he wanted to examine the details of the legislation, but he indicated preliminary support. So they're right, they might have good motivation, but it's not reflected in the figures, and it's going to be once more discrimination against dads. Even dads trying to do the right thing and trying to keep the families together. But
it just seems a retrograde, backward step. You know, you can't use the law, you know, to micromanage specific situations. The law is a humongous animal that just covers the whole of society. And you pass a law, it has so many ramifications. Unless you look into it, this is what we're suffering under at the moment. Too many inconsidered laws, but basically passed by people trying to micromanage situations inappropriately. And now we've got this hodgepodge of regulations and laws governing us that really have no consistent underlying themes or principles. And it just turns society into a minefield, basically, a legal minefield. Step in the wrong place, kaboom, blow your wallet off.
Now, a couple of other items we might just mention briefly, but we normally have Ray here and Phil York from Dads in Distress. But we'll mention this on behalf of Dads in Distress members and friends, that there is an amazing effort being undertaken by Bill Cosmopoulos, who is a dad who attends these Dads in Distress meetings, and he's decided to get out there and do something. So for the last 4 months, he's been preparing himself for his first ever triathlon in Bali next week. Bali flies out of Australia today, and he sends this message. I'm writing to let you know that finally, after 4 months of sweat, blood and tears, I'm departing for Bali to participate in the International Bali Triathlon. I'm extremely grateful, fortunate and humble with the support I've received throughout this crazy journey. This challenge has served many purposes, such as raising funds, exposure to my chosen charity, and perhaps self-development. Now, Bill has a blog, so the people that are interested in following his blog on this triathlon, he's a 40-year-old former dad in distress attender, and he's getting out there and doing something. So if you want to check his blog, go to the Dads in Distress website and follow the links for Bill Cosmopolis. So Bill, all the best from Dads on the Air, and we wish you all the best in this exciting adventure.
And be careful of what water you drink over there in Bali. you drink the wrong water, you won't be running, cycling or swimming very far at all.
Yeah, so let's hope he goes well over there. Now, just finally, there was a positive story, was on 10 News in Sydney this week. It wasn't perfect, but the 10 News at 5 story was about a weekly free baby workshop for dads run by the Benevolent Society in Bondi. And this item was broadcast on June 16. The Dads Group is an opportunity for new and expectant fathers to not only talk about their experiences, but to also gain some real practical ideas about becoming a parent. The sessions are on Wednesdays from 6 to 7.30. They're held at Scarborough House, I think 24A Ocean Street, Bondi. You can contact Jason Warne on 029-365-7999. That's 029-365-7999. And you can find out how you can attend these courses, which will provide information on the health of mother and baby, postnatal depression, work-life balance, stress management, and some particular skills for dads, including settling techniques, learning and bonding through play, and baby massage. So it's a series of free workshops. And in that connection, we'll be crossing shortly to our first guest today, who is the author David Vernon, who's recently produced a book called Men at Birth, which provides real stories from Australian men about the birth of their children. So we're looking forward to talking to David.
Okay.
So we might go to a break, and we'll be back shortly with our first guest, who's Ken Thompson, but as I said, our next guest will then be David Vernon. So looking forward to both these guests today.
Yep, so stay listening. We've got a great show. Darling wife that once I had,
Well, I'm pleased to say that she still talks to me. But I try not to think of what went wrong, 'cause if I say that I was right, she might say that she was right. And the only rights I care about are visiting rights. And any other day, I might care what you say, but every Saturday it's Father's Day. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but I've got one who calls me dad. We go when he wants to go. We do what he wants to do. I tell him it's Father's Day. And you might call it sad, you might call me mad, but it don't feel so bad when he calls me. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but it don't feel half bad when he calls me. You might call it sad, you might call me mad, but God, I feel so great when he calls me dad. Yeah, he calls me dad. I haven't always been a single man.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress. 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air this Tuesday morning, 21 June. And our first guest today is Ken Thompson. And Ken has a particular interest in international child abduction, which is a very topical subject at the moment. There was a program on the on Late Line the other night, which we might get to in a minute. But Ken, good morning and welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Good morning, Bill. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this subject.
Oh, that's a pleasure. Now, Ken, I don't know if there is a wide understanding of the topic, but perhaps could you tell us what IPCA is and what it is that the Senate's inquiring about?
Yeah, IPCA stands for International Parental Child Abduction. It's the term that's used internationally to describe the act of one parent taking a child out of the country without the consent of the other parent or without the consent of the courts. And it's an extremely widespread problem around the world and in Australia as well.
So sometimes that parent might take the child out when in the middle perhaps of a family court matter, and other times they might just, when there's no orders current, they might just disappear with the child, I guess.
Yeah, it's my experience is that most international parental child abductions take place when matters aren't before the courts. Perhaps one of the reasons for that is unless matters are before the courts, unless parenting matters are before the family court, it's not a criminal offence in Australia to take a child out of the country and then retain that child in another country. If parenting matters are before the courts already, and if parenting orders are in place, or if parenting orders are in place, it is a criminal offence under the Family Law Act. One of the difficulties that parents experience, though, is that because it's not a crime in Australia, it makes it extraordinarily difficult to get any support from Australian government agencies to help you locate your child. If the matter is before the courts, it's still quite difficult because the authorities still seem to see these as civil matters and not criminal matters, because it's not a crime under the Crimes Act, it's a crime under the Family Law Act.
Mm. And how big is the problem? Is it happening frequently? I mean, I would regard even one as a tragedy, but is it happening frequently?
Yeah, look, internationally we're talking thousands and thousands of children every year. It's actually now being referred to as the silent epidemic because people don't know very much about it. In Australia, the figures, it's very hard to work out the exact figures. The official figures are around about 125 to 150 children a year. That's about 3 children a week being taken out of the country without the consent of a parent, and those children then not being returned. That figure, though, only captures children who have been taken to countries that are signatories to the Hague Convention on the Civil Aspects of International Child Abduction. It doesn't include the large number of children who were taken to countries that aren't signatories. So the official figure is around about 150, but the authorities and other people who've done research into this area, although it's still quite limited research, would put that figure closer to about 300 children a year. Now, that's roughly one child a day being taken out of Australia.
Well, I mean, well, I think that's right to describe that as an epidemic. I mean, that's... if people were aware of that extraordinarily high number, maybe some more action might be taken, but you know, a child a day going missing is outrageous.
It's extraordinary. One good way to think about this is if there were 10 school buses, each carrying 30 children, that disappeared every year in Australia, there'd be enormous action taken, enormous, you know, public outcry, media attention and political action to try and prevent that from happening in the first place and to do everything possible to try and find those children.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we're losing 300, maybe, you know, could be up to 300, could be more than 300 children a year. Mm. And, you know, very little seems to be done to firstly prevent it and then secondly to recover those children.
Yes, now you mentioned the Hague Convention. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, because was that introduced for a similar sort of purpose?
Yeah, well, the Hague Convention was introduced in 1980, and Australia was actually one of the first countries to sign the convention. And the convention is an international legal instrument. It's a document or a convention that was held by the United Nations. And the Hague Convention is a United Nations instrument. It's the only legal instrument that's available at the moment for the return of children who've been abducted from one country to another. There are about 80-odd countries that are signatories to the convention, but that means there's still a lot of countries that aren't signatories. Now, the convention relies very much on cooperation between the countries that are signatories to it. Some countries are very, very compliant. Other countries are not as compliant as perhaps they should be, and there are other countries that simply don't comply with their international convention obligations at all.
Yes, and I wonder, even in those countries that are reasonably compliant, how much faith and how much weight can we give to the fact that a country is a member of the Hague Convention? I mean, is it still a process to try and get your child back from a country where there is a Hague Convention in force?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. It's not as straightforward as it sounds. The convention is intended to have a child return to the country it was taken from the time it's actually located, which is another problem in itself. The child should be returned within about 6 weeks. But the legal processes in the countries that the children have been taken to can often mean that can take anywhere from months to years. 5 to 6 months is not uncommon. You have to make an application under the provisions of the Hague Convention for your child to be returned. That then has to be heard in a court in the country the child has been taken to. Different countries have different appeal processes. Some countries might have one level of appeal, others might have more. But the parent who's taken the child generally has no intention of having that child returned for whatever reason. And they will generally exhaust the appeal process in the hope that the court in the country they're in will order that the child can remain in that country. And quite unfortunately, in an increasing number of cases, that's exactly what's happening.
Mm. So I think this is taken into account when a court sets a bond for a parent that wants to take a child out of the country. If it's a Hague Convention country, they'll work out the dollar amount of the bond. But from what you say, that's not really going to work if you've got to allow for spending, you know, months and months in another country trying to enforce the Hague Convention.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's a case I'm familiar with in Victoria where the father, pleaded with the court to not allow the children to be taken to the mother's country. She wanted to take the children there for a visit. He'd been arguing against that. I think she'd tried five or six times before that to get permission from the court. Eventually the court agreed. The judge said, the country she's going to is a Hague Convention country. If anything happens, he can simply make an application under the provisions of the Hague Convention. I think she was required to lodge some kind of bond. And of course, as soon as she was out of the country, she disappeared with the children. Mm-hmm. It took him, I think, 6 months to track the children down. And he did most of the work himself. And the children were eventually found and returned to Australia. But it was a terrible ordeal that he and the children had to go through.
Yes. Another story I saw in the news, and I think it was a Lateline program, Lachlan Leishman. Are you familiar with his case?
Yeah, Lachie and his son Cameron. Cameron was abducted to Zimbabwe in 2008. He was 4 years old at the time, and he hasn't had any contact with his father as far as I know. Since then, his father has lodged an application under the Hague Convention with the Zimbabwean government, but so far he hasn't had any success.
Yes, well, in the program it made the point that there are no complaints against the father, Lachlan Leishman. There is no allegation of domestic violence. He's done all the right things. But at the end, his child is gone and really nothing in prospect. But I noticed...
It's very difficult
to... Yeah, sorry?
Sorry. There's not a lot of preventative measures within Australia. The only thing you can do is be careful about signing a passport application, because in Australia it requires both parents to sign the passport application for a child. But if that child already has a passport... Mm. The other parent can just simply get on a plane or a ship and get out of the country. The only other thing that you can do is if you're concerned that your child might become a victim of an international parental child abduction, is to make an urgent application to the family court for an airport watch to be put in place. But most people have no experience with the family court. Mm. I certainly didn't know about the airport watch, and my case was before the family court. Mm. All too often these abductions take place very, very suddenly. There's often quite an amount of planning that's gone on before the abduction takes place. And the parent whose child is abducted has really no inkling that something is about to happen, and even if they do, they don't really know where to go to have that measure put in place. It's quite a simple measure, but it's not known to most of us.
Mm.
And to have that kind of airport watch put in place, you need to engage a lawyer. The lawyer needs to make an application on your behalf. It has to be heard by a judge or a magistrate. Then you have to put up a case to argue why that should be put in place. The only exception to that is if your concern is that the child is going to be taken out of the country immediately and it's outside court hours. There's a telephone number that you can call, and you can get onto a magistrate, an out-of-hours magistrate or on-call magistrate, and hopefully that magistrate will put the airport watch in place. But very, very, very few people know about that.
Mm. Look, as I understand it, you can apply for that the international watch if you've made an application to the court, like even before it's heard. And the federal police are fairly receptive, but they I think they're getting a bit sick and tired of it because they're getting so many applications. They're starting to chafe with this sort of thing going on, but. If it's your child, you want that airport watch in place.
That's right, but I think you still have to go through a lawyer, and you have to go through the court to get the airport watch in place. You can't just contact the AFP say, look, I've got a concern. They won't accept your request. That has to come from the court.
Yes, and so the lawyers really need to be perhaps more aware of it, and the parents know about it, raise it with the lawyer and ask, what the situation is, and that might jog his memory or jog her memory to get something moving on that.
But you've got to act very, very quickly because, you know, once you become aware that a parent is about to abduct a child, it's often, you know, getting to the point where it's almost too late.
I take your point also about the planning. I've no doubt this sort of thing, there would have been a lot of secret planning going on before the actual disappearance, which you find out about later. Now, just coming back to the criminality of it, you mentioned that in Australia it's not a criminal offence unless there are actually orders in place from the family court. Is that the same situation in, say, the UK and the US?
Now, from what I can gather, and it's a little bit hard to get information from all the countries, but from what I can gather, countries like the UK, the US, I think even New Zealand, but I'm not 100% certain about that, most of the developed countries have provisions within their legal frameworks for the international abduction of a child to be a criminal offence. Australia does and doesn't. It's a bit of an anomaly. In Australia, it is a criminal offence if matters are before the courts. It's not a criminal offence if they're not. With it being a criminal offence, it does open up a lot of other opportunities for you to perhaps locate where your child might be. And it also enables, I think it would act as a deterrent, although I'm probably the first to admit that if a parent is determined to take a child, the deterrence value may not be so high. But it enables the abducting parent to gain access to far more resources than they're able to under the current arrangements.
Yes,
the criminality is not about punishing the parent who's taken the child. Although I think, you know, everybody would agree that somebody who's done that has to be held to account in some way. But it's more about enabling authorities to carry out actions that they're just simply not empowered to do at the moment, which makes the onus of responsibility falls back onto the parent whose child has been abducted to do practically everything. Particularly if you don't know the country the child has been taken to, because the Hague Convention requires the parent whose child has been abducted to identify the country the child has been taken to so that the Australian authorities can lodge an application with that country. Unless you can demonstrate that your child is in that country, the other country won't accept your application.
So you've got to become a detective as well.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, these days in Europe, in particular, that's incredibly difficult to do because since the establishment of the Schengen area, which now, you know, brings in, I can't remember how many countries, but, you know, 20-odd countries in Europe, there are still borders, but there are no border controls anymore in those countries. So you can travel quite freely from country to country in Europe without being challenged, without being stopped, and without having to show any form of identification whatsoever. So it's very, very easy for an abducting parent to disappear in an area like Europe now.
Oh, it couldn't be easier. There's no check at all when you go from, say, France to Belgium or France to Spain, or, you know, you just drive across.
Exactly. Yeah, well, I went through, you know, numerous countries while I was over there, and I wasn't challenged once. I wasn't asked to show my passport once. I think there were only a few camping grounds that I stopped at where people asked me for my passport, and I asked them, oh, why do you want my passport? I was curious, you know. And they said, for market research, we just wanted to know what countries people come from. That was it. That was the only, you know.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable, you know. They wanted to put it in their database so that they could develop their advertising campaigns.
Yeah, it's a bit different from what we're talking about, but... Well, just going back to that criminal side too, I mean, I guess if it's made criminal, then you have the resources of Interpol as well, wouldn't you? To be able to try and track them.
Right. You know, without it being a criminal offence, about the most you can expect from Interpol is what they call a yellow notice, and that has to be requested by the Australian Federal Police. And a yellow notice is simply, it's nothing more than a missing person notice. Now, Lockie's case is a good example of, you know, how ineffective that can be on its own. There was a yellow notice issued for Cameron. Cameron and his mother were able to travel in and out of, I think, 6 or 7 different countries. They were actually stopped in South Africa at Johannesburg Airport, and they were interrogated because of the yellow notice. The passports were removed, and then they were immediately given the passports back again. So, you know, absolutely nothing happened with a yellow notice. The blue notice is the next one up. And that does send a signal, does send a message, but an arrest warrant really has to be in place for that to happen. And a blue notice sends a signal that that person has committed a crime in the country that has requested the notice and is in all likelihood committing crimes in another country. That will generally, you know, get some kind of response from the authorities when they detect the blue notice for a person. The next one up is a red notice, and that's effectively an international arrest warrant. And, you know, when that's issued, the authorities in the other countries do take these cases very seriously. But what I've learned is that authorities, particularly police authorities in other countries, once they learn that it's not a criminal offence in Australia, they say, well, if it's not a crime in your country, why should we take it so seriously?
Yeah,
so there's always kind of knock-on effects through it not being a criminal offence. Getting passports cancelled is almost impossible unless a crime has been committed. You know, and a passport is probably one of the most important pieces of documentation that you can act on, but it's incredibly difficult to get done.
Yes. Now, well, I guess one of the things parents can do, you mentioned some practical steps, but I guess the other thing they can do is to make a submission to the Senate inquiry that's proceeding at the moment.
Yeah, look, the Senate inquiry is a great initiative, and I'm really pleased it's come about, and so are many other parents who are in similar situations, or parents and organisations that are just very, very concerned about this now that it's, you know, sort of higher in the public mind than it was even just a couple of years ago. The background to it, from what I can gather, is that Senator Ian MacDonald was able to persuade the Senate that the issue was of such significance now that there needed to be, you know, further action taken and an inquiry established. That apparently came about, he was approached by Warren Entsch, who's the Liberal whip, and he is Lockie Leishman's federal member.
Oh.
So when he became aware of Lockie's case and Cameron's case, you know, they did more research and found that the problem was far more widespread than they realised. And between the two of them, they were able to get this Senate inquiry established. And the government announced it in, I think it was May, the 11th of May. The closing date for the submissions is the 29th of July. And then the committee will carry out its investigations, and it will be calling witnesses to give evidence to the inquiry. And it has to prepare a report or provide a report to the Senate on the 31st of October.
Yeah, that's, it seems like a long way away, but that's pretty quick for a commission to be reporting, particularly if they're going to be having hearings. But now, can anyone send a submission on this?
Yeah, the Senate inquiry process is open to anyone. You don't have to be a parent whose child has been abducted. You don't have to be a representative of a missing person organisation or a parenting organisation. If you have any thoughts about this issue at all, then the Senate inquiry would welcome submissions. I think it's important that they get as many submissions as possible so that they realise how serious people in the community are taking this issue now that it's become higher in their minds.
Yes, well, if even the parents of those children that have been abducted could sit down and send something off, because it's relatively easy to get a submission in, as I understand it.
Yeah, the committee of a Senate inquiry process is probably one of the easiest government processes I've ever seen. You know, there's no prescribed format. They'll accept submissions in any kind of, in any way. It could be in the form of a letter, it could be a report, it could be a research paper, it could be a personal experience, it can just be, you know, someone else's, someone expressing a concern about the current situation. The terms of reference they're pretty wide. It includes the costs and the terms and the conditions of the legal and departmental assistance for parents whose child has been abducted overseas. So that's looking more, I guess, the role of government and the cost of government providing assistance to parents whose children have been abducted. The effectiveness of the Hague Convention in returning children who were wrongly removed or retained, that's an important one, and that's one where I think quite a lot of submissions will focus, because a lot of people have quite serious concerns about the effectiveness of the Hague Convention now that it's 30 years old. The roles of the various Commonwealth departments involved in returning children who were wrongly removed or retained, and policies, practices and strategies that could be introduced to streamline the return of abducted children. And there's a catch-all, which is any other related matters.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's good in that, you know, you don't have to address the first four issues specifically. If you've got a general concern or if you have concerns that are outside the other terms of reference, then, you know, you can make your submission on that basis. And I would encourage anyone who has a concern about this to make a submission. This can affect any child or any parent in Australia. You know, Australia is a very multicultural society. There are lots of marriages between different nationalities. And when those marriages fail, that's when the likelihood of a child being abducted out of this country increases quite dramatically. So it can happen to a very large number of families in this country.
Yes, and when that happens, you're under such stressful in such a stressful situation, you're probably not thinking logically and what you should be doing. So it now's the time to do it. And I don't think we should just assume that it's going to get up, because I think back the end of April there was a report from one of the family advisory bodies to the Attorney General recommending against criminalising abduction.
Yeah, which seems quite odd, because it's already a crime under one scenario. And to the parents whose children have been abducted, it seems to us that the government is more concerned about the affront that's caused to the court, you know, by the parent taking the child when matters are before the court, than they are about the child itself. It just doesn't make sense why it's a criminal offence under one scenario, but it's not a criminal offence under the other.
Mm. Yeah, more the court procedure.
So we don't want to criminalise it because it acts as a barrier to the abducted child being returned. But, you know, it's already a criminal offence. It's certainly, you know, one case I'm very familiar with. It was one of the issues that the court in that country argued against the child remaining in the country, because the parent who had abducted the child was facing extradition. So the argument that the child had become settled in that country was much, much weaker, because the fact that a crime had been committed in this country and the government was seeking the return of the child and the child's parents.
Yes, and once again, you know, we like the legislation to be based on facts rather than, you know, what the latest lobby group has suggested. So we can only hope that that there is a volume of submissions sent in and you know, supporting some sensible action to reduce this incredible toll on our children.
Yeah. Incredible, and I can tell you it doesn't end when the child is located and returned either. You know, the trauma is ongoing. The effects on the child are terrible, and the effects on the, you know, the rest of the child's family and friends, it just gets, you know, it's extreme.
Yeah,
it's seen as an extreme act of abuse against a child, and one of the most extreme acts of abuse against a child that one parent can inflict, that a parent can inflict on their own child. Yeah. And more needs to be done to firstly prevent it.
Yes.
And secondly, to have those children returned as quickly as possible. And the Senate inquiry might just give us the vehicle to bring about some changes.
Yes, well,
if anyone wants to contact me about this, or if they want to, you know, make a submission or, you know, get some advice, they can contact me on my email address. Would you like me to give you that?
It's up to you, Ken, if you want to put it on, or if you want to refer them to your website, that's up to you.
No, I'll give you the email. It's easier. It's Ken Thompson, Thompson, at fastmail, that's fastmail, .fm, as in FM radio.
Great. Well, look,
I'll be happy to talk to anyone who wants some advice about this.
Well, that's terrific, and thank you for doing that, and we only wish you all the best, and we're certainly very supportive here of some action being taken against this terrible practice that's grown up. This I suppose it goes along with easier international travel that this international child abduction has mushroomed. So Ken, I'm sure you'll be following the progress of the Senate inquiry, I'm just wondering if you'd be able to talk to us again at some later date as to how it's all going and perhaps
the
outcome.
Yeah, I'd happily do that. I'd be very pleased to do that, Bill.
Well, that's fantastic. And so, Ken, look, we wish you all the very best, and let's hope that there is some positive action in this area. So, once again, Ken Thompson, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks very much. Bye.
Okay, bye.
flashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. Caught in a trap, they must learn to survive. So they join with their parent who hates, cheats and lies. After a while, they both act the same. The brainwashing parent and a child without shame. A child is not born with hate in their heart. It's taught in a household where parents live apart. The parents they live with use fear and control to brainwash their children since the court gave them this role. Our children are stolen by stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. The child does not know when deception occurs. They're too young to recognize denigration and slurs. To hate the other parent is rewarded with praise. They're not free to think as they're locked in a cage. Surely it's abuse when this behavior persists. Their childhood destroyed by these parental terrorists. Dysfunctional thoughts can make them angry or depressed. Inflicted by these parents who are sick and obsessed. Our children are stolen by stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. One day the child will seek out the past. Faced with the truth, it will leave them aghast. They will discover how lies changed their life, how helpless they were, and how lucky to survive. To all who take part or do nothing to prevent this abuse of our children who continue to lament the loss of a parent when they are growing up. You will stand condemned as weak and corrupt. Our children are stolen by stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough.
They grew so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air this Tuesday, 21st of June, 2011. And our next guest is David Vernon. David is an award-winning freelance writer and editor and the father of two boys. In recent years, he has focused on chronicling women's and men's experience of childbirth and promoting better support for pregnant women and their partners. David lives with his family in the outskirts of Canberra, and the full range of his work can be viewed on his website, which is www.davidvernononeword.net, and that's V-E-R-N-O-N. David has recently produced a new and updated edition of Men at Birth, in which 23 dads interviewed and provide their stories. David, good morning.
Good morning, Bill. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. David, you've got these stories from the 23 men, and I think you've had a little bit of your own story. How did you come to choose these particular dad stories?
It was a very tricky task because I received many, many more stories than, in fact, I could use in the book. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to provide the whole range. Well, birth is an incredibly individual experience, so you can't provide every example, but I wanted to give an example of the types of births and experiences that men would come across. And so I included, you know, breech birth, cesarean births, twin births, vaginal birth after cesarean, home births, labor ward births, birth center births, traumatic births. So I tried to give a range so that men, when they actually do attend the birth of their own baby, they can feel at least some men have been there before them.
Yes, look, very, very worthwhile. I suppose I should put my cards on the table. I've had two children, and I was present for both of them being born. And it really is. It's one of the. It's the experience of your life, I think. Really, isn't it? It seems
to be
the theme of all the dads coming through. But what an incredible experience it is.
I think that's an interesting point, is even though the book does include some traumatic births and births which didn't go at all as intended, the men still felt afterwards that the entire process, that it was all worth it.
Mm. And in picking these particular 23 from, I don't know how many applications you had, but I understand quite a few of them were rejected for space reasons, I suppose, but... Were you looking for anything in particular with those with the people you included?
I think I felt it was important that I didn't actually try and provide any particular slant in the book. I didn't want to be pushing any particular approach, except for noting that the men who had good birth support, that is, you know, they had assistance from good midwives, doctors, obstetricians or doulas, did a lot better and had a much better experience than those men who, you know, went in there not prepared, not knowing their birth team. So I guess that was the one area I was trying to encourage men to look at, is to look at the birth team that they're gathering around them and go in prepared.
Now, that's a word that I even looked up in the dictionary and couldn't find. A doula. Could you perhaps...
Yes, it's a relatively new term. Well, it's been around for a few years now. But what it is it's a woman who goes in to support the labouring woman. And it's a bit sad, in fact, that that's actually had to happen in society. Because, of course, in the past, when a woman went in to give birth, she took along with her sister or a sister-in-law or a mother, women who had all given birth before and could provide the emotional support that the woman needs. However, in our modern way of doing things, which is, you know, quick whip in to the labour ward, get whoever's on duty and out again, you don't get that emotional support that's required. And so there's a new group of women who are out there who offer their services, who've had babies, who've attended many births before, who can actually go along with the woman and the man and actually provide a lot more understanding and emotional support than the medical practitioners can give.
Mm. And yet, I noticed, I think you say in your foreword that fewer than 0.5% of births in Australia are home births. Is that something that you think is a good thing or a bad thing or something that's going to change?
My view on home birth, it's a very vexed area. My view is that women should give birth wherever they feel safest. Some women don't feel at all safe in hospitals. And in fact, that we know that if a woman doesn't feel safe, then the hormones that are needed to have a quick and safe and successful birth aren't there, because the hormone adrenaline kicks in and shuts down hormones like oxytocin, which help open up the body. And so if you're feeling fearful or anxious or worried, then you're not going to give birth successfully. So the answer for where a birth should be is wherever the woman feels safest and most secure. Home birth is becoming much, much rarer in Australia, mostly because you can't obtain the midwives who are really needed to attend to make the birth safe. Mm. There are very few independent midwives around in the country these days who will actually come up to your home and attend.
And I guess that's where the usual arguments arise. I mean, this hospital birthing is relatively recent. I think it's probably only from the not even all of the 20th century, probably from about the 20s or the 30s. Would that be right?
About the 1920s that everyone started going to hospitals. That was seen as the dumb place to have them. So it's different all across the world. In the UK, home births are around 3 or 4%, so significantly higher than in Australia.
Mm. Well, I guess the main concern is that from discussions with a midwife, as I understand it, when things do go wrong with a baby, they go wrong very quickly, much quicker perhaps than with older patients. And I suppose that's the concern. What are we going to do if there is a serious problem?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why it's very important, if you're considering to have a home birth, is that you have an experienced midwife with you, because she carries all the equipment that's required to deal with emergencies that arise in the first 20 to 30 minutes, which is in fact the amount of time you'd need to get to a hospital. If you're really out in the sticks, then you might want to consider being a lot closer to a hospital than somewhere within at least 30 to 40 minutes drive. You don't want to be too far away, but having a qualified midwife with you will deal with any of those emergencies that arise in those first few minutes. But really, for normal, healthy women who are having, not a complex pregnancy and doesn't have complex or chronic problems, then very little is likely to go wrong in that time. And a good midwife will notice if something's happening which is going wrong and will suggest a transfer. I think often people see that when you start off with a home birth and then transfer to a hospital, that's proof that home birth is unsafe.
Mm.
In fact, what it is evidence that the midwife has acted properly and moved to a more appropriate location where issues can be dealt with.
Yes. I guess, I've heard that we shouldn't be encouraging dads to do the movie type approach of, jumping in the car, revving the engine and, going through red lights and going up the wrong way, one-way streets and doing all that in order to get to the hospital on time. It's probably more important that that things are relaxed. I mean, apart from dangers on the road, but I think you should encourage the fathers to just perhaps settle down a bit.
Oh, absolutely, Bill. I think it's important that most men get their information about birth, sadly, from the movies.
Mm.
And birth there is always portrayed as dramatic, intense, and an emergency. It is hardly ever portrayed as relaxed, lengthy. You never really see that, it always seems to be very, very quick.
Yes.
Many labours will go for hours and hours and hours. There's some in the Men at Birth book which have gone for days.
Yes.
And so most experience that men have is it's an emergency. When your partner goes into labour, you can have a leisurely drive to the hospital. There's nothing urgent about it in most cases.
Mm.
And if we're talking about transfers or if it's an emergency, then that's when you call the ambulance.
Mm.
So you don't do it yourself.
No. Well, I think that's got to be discouraged. The midnight flash through town. But now you mentioned about midwives and perhaps a lack of them in Australia. I imagine that's got something to do with the insurance availability, isn't it?
Oh, you're spot on. With the lack of insurance for midwives in Australia, what has happened is that the insurance companies that used to insure home birth midwives have pulled out of the market, and therefore midwives currently who offer home birth services are not covered with insurance, which is no good for consumers, and it's no good for the midwives either. And until that's resolved, you are really limiting the number of midwives who are willing to put their house on the line to offer services at home.
Yes, and I guess it cuts both ways too. I mean, the parents apart from they may not want her to put her house on the line, or there are a few male midwives too, I'm sure, that they're not going to be, they're not going to receive compensation for if something does go wrong, and it is perhaps the midwife's fault, or there's some negligence issues. And I think, as I understand it, the obstetrician's professional indemnity insurance is one of the highest in medicine. So if they're going to extend it to midwives, you would think there's going to be a healthy premium, unless the government can also get involved.
Yes, I think that's true. And in fact, I recall that obstetric premiums are in fact subsidised by the government. Mm-hmm. And therefore you'd expect that midwifery insurance should be subsidised as well if it arises. Mm. I think it's a bit sad, though, is that we've reached this stage, because consumers seem to have forgotten that, regretfully, bad things do happen in life. And some issues in birth, and it doesn't matter what expert you have there, may not, in fact, save your baby from being harmed or dying in the process. Mm. And it is still one of those risky things in life, is having a baby. And yet we as consumers seem to think that if anything goes wrong, then somebody somewhere is at fault and we must sue them.
Mm.
And because of that approach, you know, the American approach I think we've adopted here, is that we're making a rod for our own back. Is that many services are falling by the wayside because we think we need to sue.
Yes. I've never seen a split of what the lawsuits are for, but I have heard the horror stories from America where, you know, it's if the child's not doing well at school, they sue the obstetrician. And, some crazy examples of where you're finding lawsuits, you know, where trying to get it back onto the obstetrician for some reason.
Well, that's right. Nobody is ever responsible for their own actions any longer. It seems. Yep. Someone else has to be.
Yes, this is right in the middle of it, and also, I mean, obviously, perhaps the most emotional area of our whole existence. So I guess I can't see that changing, really.
No, and particularly around birth, because it is such an emotional experience. Everybody wants the absolute best for their child. Having a baby is an expression of the future for you as a family, and therefore you want, you know, the perfect outcome.
Mm.
And sometimes, very, very rarely, and Australia's maternity system is incredibly safe, very, very rarely things do go wrong.
Mm. Well, that's good to know. Well, I guess, you know, in leading up to the birth, you mentioned for the healthy mother that she should take that into account in deciding where she's going to have the birth. So I suppose there is that need for the medical, I don't know if you call it intervention, but certainly medical monitoring of the mother through the pregnancy, just to make sure that there aren't going to be any of these issues, at least known issues or knowable issues that are going to arise at the time of the birth.
I think that's very important, is that you need to choose a carer that you feel comfortable with and, in fact, go and see regularly. There is a downside to the medical monitoring side of things, is that, in fact, it can make you worried. There are negatives. I mean, once again, we as humans seem to seek out the perfect birth, the perfect monitoring system. We, in fact, think that our medical system will deliver us 100% results. In fact, some of the monitoring is fairly inaccurate. For example, we use ultrasound dating for working out when the baby is due. That, in fact, is pretty inaccurate. Only about less than 5% of babies arrive on their due date.
Yes, I think in reading your book, I was amazed how many dads mentioned that fact, that the due date either came and went or was in the distance somewhere.
Well, absolutely, and that is so important, the due date, because under our medical model of managing birth, is that women are monitored against protocols. And if you fall outside the average or whatever the hospital has decided is that protocol, then that's when the hospital will intervene and do something about it. And so whilst the monitoring is really helpful, it can also have some downsides.
Mm.
And I think as a society we are tending to expect a lot more from our monitoring systems than they actually can deliver. For example, now in the past, women may have had, well, they had no ultrasounds at all in the past, but in the recent past, people would have one ultrasound at the beginning of their pregnancy to check everything was okay, that, you know, there was no Down syndrome and issues like that. As time has got on, people now have two or three routine ultrasounds. Mm. And they're expensive to the medical system. They may not provide any basis for making decisions. And even if they do find something wrong, what we find is that the women and the men are not necessarily given the counselling to work out what to do. If you discover at 6 months that your baby has some deformity because of an ultrasound, do they then work through what you should do about it? Mm. And often they don't. They actually leave people feeling very anxious. And, you know, how bad is that deformity, et cetera, et cetera. And do we abort? And, of course, it gets too late to abort after a while if you're going to go down that path.
Mm.
And so there's a flip side to this monitoring. It can be actually quite stressful for the parents.
Oh, I'm sure. It just going for the monitoring on occasions, the amniocentesis is obviously very stressful because I think the doctors will say, you know, don't if you're not prepared to take action in the event of a bad finding, well, we're not going to even do it. And I suppose there are so many sides to this, aren't there?
Oh, there are. And the flip side to the amniocentesis, in fact, it slightly increases the chance of a miscarriage.
Mm.
So your choice of... And as long as that's all explained before you go down that path, that, you know, you're increasing the chance of a miscarriage by having an amniocentesis, and then what do you do once you discover it?
Mm.
Do you make the decision to go ahead or do you terminate? And sometimes you find that when you terminate, in fact, the child does not have Down syndrome.
Oh, that'd be devastating.
Absolutely. So there's no perfection in this, and this is what's really tricky about these birth issues.
Mm.
And yet, I think medical practitioners like to sell the monitoring and the systems they've got, as in, we'll do this, 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 and this, and that implies you'll get a perfect outcome. So, in fact, many medical practitioners, I think, produce a rod for their own back on this.
Yes, look, I think there's more consciousness of all the issues that you raise in your book and that we've just been talking about, because, I mean, my understanding is that they will not do amniocentesis for mothers who are under a certain age. So even if the mother says, "I really want one," I'm 23 years old, but I just want to make sure I don't have a Down syndrome child. And my understanding is the doctors won't do it.
So I hope that's true. I think that's very pleasing if that's the case.
Mm, well, yes.
I'd like to see a few more restrictions on some of these activities. Even ultrasound, we've never done a randomised controlled trial to discover whether ultrasound has an impact on the embryo, on the growing baby.
Mm.
It was a medical technology which is devised in the 1950s, and the obstetrician who picked it up thought it was a damn good idea to see whether this technology, which was used for testing metal, the strength of metal, is in fact any good on his women patients.
That's where it came from, isn't it?
Yeah, its history is very checkered. It came from an engineering background, not a medical tool at all. And whilst obviously it is very useful, we don't know if it actually has an impact. And whilst you think that one ultrasound is probably fine, we know that some women have 4, 5, 6 ultrasounds, and there are now clinics that are set up to allow you to take multiple photos of your child. You know, you go along not for any medical reason, but you go along so you can get a happy snapshot of your baby in the womb.
Mm.
And when they go to 3D imaging, that's a lot of ultrasound.
Mm.
And we don't know their face yet.
Yes, well, this whole area is really, surprisingly, it seems to be a lot more research is needed. I mean, even on the whole question of home births versus hospital births, there really aren't any comprehensive studies, as I understand it, as to, to more satisfactorily perhaps deal with the risks issues that are raised from time to time.
Incredibly hard to devise a study. How can you go along to a woman and a partner and say, we would like you to put you in a randomized controlled trial of home birth, for example, and we're going to put you in the home birth group when you vehemently don't want to do it, or we're going to put you in the hospital group and you don't want to do it. You know, so you can't do a randomized controlled trial of many of these areas in the medical field, because it takes away people's consent and their right to do what they want. And if you have groups that are purely self-selected, then in fact it's not going to be a randomised trial.
Yes, I think we've got to be wary of those self-selected groups. So, yes, it's a bit of a poser, isn't it? And yet it's such an important area.
Yes, it is. And we need the people to keep looking at these questions about safety, because they help shine the light on a whole range of different aspects of giving birth. And, I mean, there's been some very large trials overseas, and what they've been looking at is what are called meta-analyses, where they look at lots and lots of different studies and put them all together, and so get very large groups of people. And what has generally been found is that for a normal, healthy woman, a home birth can be as safe, if not safer, than a hospital birth. It's when you start having complexities in the birth, in the woman's labour, that in fact safety drops off.
Mm. And I guess that's going to affect the any research as well, because it's probably the home birth sample will be of, you know, healthy women, pregnancy proceeding normally, everything fine, whereas the hospital, of course, they get everyone, not just the healthy women. So yeah, there'd have to be someone else for that.
And then it comes down to issues like which hospital do you choose. We know that some private hospitals in Queensland have a cesarean rate of over 50%.
Mm.
Now, that's quite horrifying. I think that every second woman who walks into that hospital ends up having a cesarean. While public hospitals have significantly lower cesarean rates. So you have to ask, you know, what are the protocols here? And so doing studies like this are really vexed, and it's not an area that I've got any skills in, thank goodness.
Yes, and it tends to be self-perpetuating then, because if you've had a cesarean, just from what I've seen on this, it appears that you increase the risks for a home birth in future because of having had that cesarean the first time round.
Yes, that area is a very contentious one about whether you can have what's called a VBAC, a vaginal birth after a cesarean. Many obstetricians wouldn't consider that. This does seem to be growing. A lot of evidence to suggest that, in fact, a vaginal birth after cesarean is quite reasonable to have, again, depending, you know, whether you're a healthy woman. But these things are changing all the time. There is no clear evidence on many of these issues, and this makes it so difficult for women and men to work out what they should do.
Mm.
If you can find a competing study on nearly everything.
Mm. And then feel guilty about it at the end of all that. We're speaking with David Vernon, who's the author of Men at Birth, which has recently been released in a new and updated edition from Finch Publishing. And David, perhaps just returning to your book, I've read the 23 stories. Would you particularly draw the reader's attentions to in those 23 stories?
I think the main issue is the sheer diversity of men's experiences. Is that not one of those men had the same experience as another. They all had different lengths of the natural birth. They all had different birth helpers. They all had different they nearly all had really good outcomes.
Hmm.
I think the important thing for any man preparing for the birth of their child is not have too great an expectation that it's going to go any particular way. Because you'll find that while birth plans are really useful documents to prepare because they actually make you think about lots of different issues that normally you wouldn't think about, it is very, very rare for a birth to ever go via the birth plan. So I think men need to be flexible in their approach to planning their birth. I think the other thing that many men don't think about is how fit they actually have to be. Parenting, as you well know, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Mm.
And whether it's the actual birth itself, which, you know, could be a really intense 4-hour period, or it might in fact go for 3 or 4 days, once you're over it, the birth itself can be intense and take a lot of effort if you're in there supporting your partner, holding her up, moving around, doing things like that. But straight afterwards, you've got the lack of sleep, and then, as you know,
mm-hmm.
It's pretty tough being a parent.
Yeah.
So you need to be fit as well. And I think the third issue is that the men need to understand what their partner wants out of the birth. Obviously, they want a safe birth, which is healthy, and where they're not particularly badly injured or damaged by the birth. But there's sometimes the women have real emotional needs that need to be met, and men don't understand that sometimes. Because men, as a rule, we don't talk about this stuff. I'm really pleased you're talking about it, Bill, but you go down to the pub, men don't talk about what it's like to be at a birth. And men generally don't talk with women about what they would like out of it from an emotional point of view. And if you can have a good birth, then parents are really set up well for the future.
Yes, and hence the need for this book, which I think is very timely, because you know, you can tell these are real stories. The dads are describing what it's like, and you know, I still feel there's nothing like actually doing it before you really know. You can read anything you like, but your book having the actual words of the dads is an enormous contribution to for dads to know what to expect. And just one thing you mentioned there, the birth plan. What would normally go into that plan that you talked about?
Well, birth plans can be as detailed or as little detailed as you like, but most people will sit down and they'll say what type of pain relief that they think is appropriate, how long they'll go in first stage or second stage before they want an intervention. They'll want to possibly list that if they're going to they would like to have an active birth, that is, get up and move around and walk around and lean over anything they want. They might put in there that they might want to labour in water, because we know that labouring in water, not necessarily having a water birth, but labouring in water provides significant pain relief. So it's mostly to do with what medical interventions you find acceptable and at what stage you want them done, and also perhaps who should be consulted. For example, some women are really quite determined that they don't want to get an injection of Syntocin at the end to help expel the placenta. They wish to do it naturally, so they might write in their birth plan no Syntocin to be given, unless, you know, the woman agrees. Mm. So issues like that.
Yes, sort of have a run first, which might have to be thrown out at the last minute, but nevertheless, it's good to have all this sorted out before you get there. David, I think we're running out of time, which I'm sure we could talk for hours about this. It's a fascinating book, and I'd recommend everybody to look out for this, Men at Birth, edited by David Vernon, published by Finch Publishing. And, David, is there a website where they could perhaps they could have a look at something about the book, or perhaps get a feel for these things?
If they go to my website, they'll find one of the stories out of the book there, and we'll find some other information about birth and how to prepare for it.
Great. So, and what's your website?
That is www.davidvernon.net.
Great. Okay. Well, David, thank you again for being on the program, and we wish you all the best with those two boys you're raising down there, and perhaps we might have another opportunity to talk to you again in the future. So thank you very much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Bill. That'd be lovely.
Great. Thanks, David.
Take care. Bye.
Hey, girl, you see everything you wanted in me. You know I gave you the world. You had me in the palm of your hand. Why your love went away, I just can't seem to understand. Thought it was me and you, baby, me and you until the end. But I guess I was wrong.
Don't wanna think about it, don't wanna talk about it. I'm just so sick about it.
Can't believe it's ending this way.
Just so confused about it, feeling the blues about it. I just can't do it without you.
Tell me, is this fair?
Is this the way it's really going? Down.
Is this how we say goodbye?
Should've known better when you came around
that you were gonna make me cry.
It's breaking my heart to watch you run around,
cause I know that you're living a lie.
But that's okay, baby, cause in time you will find
what goes around, goes around.
that you claimed. You said that you were moving on out. Maybe I should do the same. The funny thing about that is I was ready to give you my name. Thought it was me and you, baby. And now it's all just a shame that I guess I was wrong.
Don't wanna think about it. Don't wanna talk about it. I'm just so sick about it.
Can't believe it's ending this way.
Just so confused about it. Feeling confused about it. I just can't do it.
Can you tell me, is this fair? Is this the way it's really going down? Is this how we say goodbye?
Should've known better when it came around.
Should've known better that you were gonna make me cry.
And I was breaking my heart to watch you run around. I know that you're living a lie. But that's okay, baby, cause in time you will find me.
In distress, meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, the last time for today. We've just about run out of time. I want to thank particularly our guest today, David Vernon, the author of his new book published on Finch Publishing, Men at Birth, and also Ken Thompson, who spoke to us about the Senate inquiry into the international abduction of children. You can listen to this program again, or you can get any of our programs by going to our website, www.dadsontheair.net. And just a mention about next week's program. It's going to be a big program. We've got we've invited a well-known psychologist, social commentator, Hugh Mackay. So we're very much looking forward to talking to Hugh. And he's got a book out called The 10 Things That Make Us Tick. So I can't wait to find out what makes us all tick, especially some of us. So thanks for joining.
I haven't heard you tick, Bill. You're about to go bang. Doesn't that mean you're a suicide bomber?
Thanks for joining us today, and we'll look forward to your company next week and for another edition of Dads on the Air.
We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.